Welcome, Curious Minds, to The Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Murdoch, your guide through today's fascinating layers of insight.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse, ready to connect the dots and explore the broader implications of the knowledge we're about to uncover.
Today, we're embarking on a comprehensive deep dive into The Economist for the week of September 13th to 19th, 25. You've entrusted us with a pretty substantial stack of articles here, and our mission is really to distill the most critical insights, those surprising facts, and, you know, the aha moments that'll get you truly well-informed quickly and thoroughly.
Right.
We'll be reporting on, each and every article and topic in detail, discussing their impact and implications to make sure you get the complete picture without, hopefully, feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, this isn't just a summary. It's more an exploration of why these stories matter, how they connect, and, you know, what they could actually mean for you and the world around us.
Exactly. So let's unpack this crucial edition of The Economist. #I, global geopolitical tremors and economic shifts. Okay, let's jump right into the global geopolitical tremors and the economic shifts that are really shaking things up starting in Europe. It feels very much like a continent on edge right now.
It really does. The headlines are pretty stark, aren't they? Highlighting these deep anxieties about Russia, NATO, and all the internal strife going on.
Yeah, and one particularly alarming event really stands out. Russia's most far-reaching intrusion into NATO airspace, specifically over Poland.
Right, and this wasn't just, you know, a minor breach. It was a significant move, even needed help from the Netherlands in the Polish response.
Wow.
And Poland's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, he didn't mince words. He basically said it brought NATO closer to open conflict with Russia.
Gosh.
And this happened, crucially, during Russia's Zapad war games near the Belarus border. They were actually simulating a NATO attack.
Which is just chilling. It sounds exactly like the maneuvers they did in 2021, right before the Ukraine invasion.
Precisely. It's an unsettling echo, a reminder these aren't just drills. They're often clear signals of, escalating aggression.
Yeah.
And the context is even more complex. There was the arrest of a Belarusian spy, a diplomat expelled. It points to a concerted effort by Russia to, you know, test and destabilize.
Okay, that context is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications for NATO unity, mm-hmm. for their response, mm-hmm. they're huge. The article it pointed out what it called a feeble social media reaction from former President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
When you put that together with his past ambiguity about, you know, treaty obligations for allies who don't, quote, pay their bills, it really does seem like it risks emboldening Russia and, frankly, other autocratic regimes, too.
Absolutely. The Economist explicitly argues that NATO should be taking a much firmer stance here, you know, intercepting all incursions, deploying more aircraft, shifting air defense systems,
right.
even being ready to shoot down drones inside Ukrainian or Belarusian airspace if they're heading towards NATO territory. It's a call for a stronger, more unified front than perhaps what we've seen.
It really does raise that vital question. What message does perceived passivity send? Trump's inaction, despite saying he'd end the war in Ukraine. It feels like he's effectively let Vladimir Putin lead him by the nose, as the article puts it.
Yeah, he talked about ceasefires, sanctions. They just never happened. He stayed pretty quiet as attacks got worse.
And the article bluntly calls this passivity a gift to the Kremlin. It even notes Putin's response to Trump's peace ideas at one point was 800 drones a night.
Wow. It just underscores that direct link, doesn't it, between perceived Western weakness and escalating aggression. And we'll see later a similar dynamic played out with that strike on Qatar. It highlights how autocrats will read these signals and act on them.
Zooming in on Ukraine itself, the devastation is just, it's relentless. A Russian airstrike tragically killed 24 pensioners in the Donetsk region. Such a cruel attack on vulnerable people.
It's horrific. And it wasn't isolated, was it? It was part of Russia's largest attack across Ukraine since the war started, hitting various regions, even setting Kyiv's main government building on fire.
The scale, the targeting.
Yeah.
It shows a clear intent to inflict maximum damage, maximum terror.
Which brings us back to that critical analysis of Trump's role. His promise to end the war quickly hasn't just failed, his inaction is seen as directly enabling the Kremlin.
Yeah.
This passivity, it really clashes with his strong words about hating bloodshed.
Yeah.
It creates this huge disconnect that undermines America's standing, its ability to protect its allies. It's not just the words, it's the consequences of the silence, the lack of decisive action that you see playing out on the ground in Ukraine.
Okay, let's shift west now, because France is grappling with its own significant political instability. Emmanuel Macron just appointed Sébastien Lecornu as his seventh prime minister since 2017.
Seventh? That's incredible.
It followed François Bayrou losing a confidence vote over spending cuts. And that marks the second government collapse in just 9 months over budget disputes.
9 months, two governments. That's an extraordinary level of churn for a major European power. It suggests some really deep-seated problems.
Definitely. And the market reaction was, well, telling. Markets were unimpressed, is how the article put it.
Yeah.
France's borrowing costs stayed stubbornly high, even above Greece's.
Right. That signals a real lack of investor confidence in the government's ability to handle its fiscal crisis. And it's not just internal French politics. It has broader economic implications for the whole Eurozone.
And then you had the Block Everything protests erupting across France, which just underscores the deep public dissatisfaction, the huge challenges Lecornu is facing.
Yeah, his main task is to somehow break this parliamentary deadlock. That probably means finding common ground with socialists, maybe the center-right, possibly even making concessions on fiscal consolidation or a wealth tax.
Which would directly challenge Macron's usual pro-business stance, wouldn't it?
Exactly. It's a very tricky balancing act.
Meanwhile, across the channel, the UK is also deep in its own political turmoil. The Economist is calling it the new battle for Britain. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer's Labour government has faced some pretty big setbacks recently.
Yeah. First, Peter Mandelson was dismissed as ambassador to America. New revelations about his past friendship with Jeffrey Epstein just raise too many questions about him being suitable for that key role.
Right. And then Angela Rayner, the deputy leader, resigned over tax issues connected to a property sale. That was particularly problematic given her brief was, you know, housing policy.
It really paints that picture of the misery of power for labor right now.
And these events, they highlight a really fundamental shift in the UK's electoral landscape. According to the article, the old two-party model, it's disappearing.
That's the argument. Elections are now fought more within the left and right blocks, not just between them. And that's largely because Brexit has profoundly reshaped the electorate.
So smaller parties, often more populist ones like Nigel Farage's Reform UK, they're seeing a significant surge.
Exactly. And Sir Keir Starmer's strategy, trying to court reform defectors on issues like illegal migration, while also keeping his traditional left-wing base happy, well, it's proving incredibly risky.
How so?
Well, the data suggests Labour is actually losing voters across the spectrum.
Yeah.
And interestingly, its vote has held up better among richer voters and in London, which kind of challenges that historical working class roots narrative.
And this is where you really see that shift impacting things. Nigel Farage's Reform UK is gaining serious ground, mostly from unhappy conservative voters and people who didn't vote before.
Right. The article even suggests they have a coin toss chance of a majority in an election. That's a remarkable projection.
Wow.
Their recent conference really showcased the anti-establishment populist appeal. They seemed willing to embrace controversial figures, too, like an anti-vaccine activist and someone described as Britain's favorite political prisoner.
It reflects a deep anti-establishment mood, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And a willingness to push political boundaries on the right.
Definitely. And for any government trying to stabilize things, fixing Britain's, quote, broken property tax system, the council tax is just an enormous challenge.
Because it faces what the article calls loser's wrath.
Exactly. From wealthier, older homeowners in the South who'd likely see their bills go up quite a bit. Even if studies suggest more winners than losers overall, the political difficulty of pushing through revenue-neutral reforms, let alone ones that increase revenue, well, it makes it a politically brave but highly unlikely move for a government already struggling.
Yeah, classic case of a necessary but deeply unpopular reform getting sidelined by politics.
Pretty much.
Okay, rounding out this European overview, even usually stable places like Norway are seeing changes. Maybe less dramatic than France or the UK, but still significant. Labour won another term, but the Anti-Immigration Progress Party surged, actually doubling its seats.
Right, and at the same time, support for the established centre-right parties just collapsed.
So what does that mean for governing?
It means Prime Minister Jonas Gahrstoer now has to rely on a smaller alliance of left, green, and agrarian parties to get legislation passed. It just indicates a more fragmented political scene, even in Norway.
It really reflects those broader European trends, doesn't it? Declining support for traditional parties, rise of populist or specialized groups, speaks to the ongoing fragmentation across the continent. #B, Middle East escalation and humanitarian crisis. Okay, let's shift our focus now to the Middle East. We're seeing an alarming escalation there and a worsening humanitarian crisis. Maybe the most striking event covered is Israel's unprecedented strike in Qatar.
Yeah, that was huge. Israel bombed a villa in Doha, believing senior Hamas officials were meeting. Six people were killed, though their identities weren't immediately clear.
And this was a major departure, right,
yep.
from their previous policy of not targeting Hamas leaders in Qatar.
Absolutely. And the implications are profound. Qatar, which is a key U.S. ally, hosts a major American military base. They immediately called it state terrorism.
Wow.
This move directly jeopardizes the already fragile Gaza ceasefire talks. Qatar has been a key, if sometimes quiet, facilitator. It also really undermines America's diplomatic position in the Gulf. It could signal to other Gulf states that maybe those U.S. security guarantees aren't as solid as they thought.
And Trump's reaction didn't help, according to the article.
No, his bemused and feeble reaction, as the article put it, only made things worse. It undercut his own stated efforts to end the Gaza war. It raises serious questions about U.S. awareness, or maybe its inability to prevent such a strike. Either way, it damages credibility.
It gets even more complex when you look at the internal motives. The article suggests Israeli intelligence and generals actually opposed the strike.
Right. They argued it would disrupt ceasefire talks, endanger hostages, but Prime Minister Netanyahu reportedly ordered it anyway.
Why?
Partly due to criticism he was facing after a shooting in Jerusalem. It suggests internal political pressures might be heavily influencing military decisions.
And tragically, the article suggests a potential peace deal could actually destabilize his ruling coalition, which might incentivize prolonging the war.
That's a critical and deeply concerning point. It highlights that tension between long-term strategic interests and short-term political survival. The decision to strike in Qatar against the advice of his own intelligence. It suggests a government prioritizing internal stability over regional peace and the real human cost.
The article explicitly states that decision made the war in Gaza more likely to drag on. Devastating consequences for Palestinians.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza remains just dire. Israel ordered 1 million Gaza City residents to evacuate ahead of its ground offensive, Gideon's Chariots II. This followed airstrikes that killed scores.
Just imagine the logistics, the human toll of displacing 1 million people like that.
It is, as the article describes it, a grueling process, especially for injured children, the vulnerable. Evacuation is complicated by needing Israeli permits, the Rafah crossing being closed, host countries being reluctant to take people in, fearing they'll overstay.
And the U.S. response?
The U.S. actually halted visas for Palestinians. The State Department reportedly linked that decision to videos posted by a far-right activist, Laura Loomer, which is, well, a truly concerning influence on foreign policy.
Yeah.
Aid charities are stressing that medical evacuations are just a drop in the ocean. What's really needed is an end to Israel blocking aid and bombing medical facilities so Gazans can get treatment locally instead of facing forced displacement or suffering without care.
Finally, on the Middle East front, there's this persistent uncertainty around the Iran nuclear deal. The UN Atomic Agency initially claimed a deal to access Iran's main nuclear sites.
Right, which could potentially allow inspectors to assess damage from U.S.-Israeli strikes, check uranium stockpiles.
But then Iran contradicted that.
Yeah, Iran's foreign minister quickly said no agreement had actually been made yet to allow inspectors in. It just highlights the ongoing tension, the deep mistrust, the diplomatic challenges surrounding Iran's nuclear program. Even if a deal were reached, the history suggests it would be fraught with difficulties. Hashtag tech tech taxi, Asia's power struggles and social unrest.
Okay, let's turn our attention to Asia now. We're seeing its own unique power struggles and moments of social unrest there. Japan, a key U.S. ally, is going through significant leadership turmoil. Ishibe Shigeru resigned as PM after less than a year.
Yeah, that followed the LDP losing its upper house majority in July, and it marks Japan's fifth prime minister in just 5 years.
Five PMs in 5 years. That's extraordinary for Japan, usually known for stability.
It really is. And this rapid turnover makes the upcoming October 4th election to choose his replacement unusually important. It's not just about internal LDP fights between, say, hard right and centrist factions.
Right. It's also about those external challenges.
Exactly. Navigating Trump's proposed trade deal, China's increasing regional pressure. The frontrunners include Takaichi Tasuna, who could be Japan's first female leader, and Koizumi Shinjiro, who's seen as more reform-minded from a younger generation.
So the implications are pretty significant. The new leader faces intense geopolitical pressures immediately, might need to call new elections or expand the coalition just to hold on to power.
It's a very challenging environment.
Now, in stark contrast, Nepal's government was, well, literally overthrown by protests. Anti-corruption demonstrations led to PM KP Sharma Oli resigning, but it escalated into serious violence, including the prime minister's office being burned down.
Yeah, a curfew was imposed in Kathmandu to try and stop the unrest.
So what was the core issue here?
The insight is that these protests were fueled by deep economic hardship. You're talking extremely low GDP per person, really high youth unemployment, over a fifth of young people.
Wow.
Plus, endemic corruption and this pervasive public feeling of an entitled political class. The article notes a social media blackout during the crisis only made people angrier, feeling like the government was trying to silence them.
It just shows how quickly acute economic hardship, combined with perceived injustice and a lack of transparency, can destabilize a nation. Okay, let's shift gears now and zoom out to some of the grander narratives shaping our world, starting with a truly profound one. This demographic shift suggesting humanity will shrink, and much sooner than most projections indicate.
Yeah, this is a big one. The core idea is that fertility rates are plummeting globally. And it's not just a rich country thing anymore.
Right.
Two-thirds of the world's population now live in countries below that replacement rate of 2.1 births per woman. And get this, Bogota, Colombia now has a lower fertility rate, 0.91, than Tokyo at 0.99.
Bogota, lower than Tokyo. That really challenges the conventional wisdom.
It absolutely does. Most existing demographic forecasts, the article argues, are basically inflated by implausible assumptions, especially the idea that fertility rates will just, you know, bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
The Economist's analysis shows that even short delays in this assumed recovery drastically changed the peak population predictions. Like, if fertility rates keep declining for just one more year, the global peak arrives 3 years sooner with 130 million fewer people.
Wow. 1 year makes that much difference.
Yeah. It makes a sustained contraction of the global population seem more or less inevitable, which profoundly challenges those long-held assumptions about continuous growth.
And this is where it gets really thought-provoking. This shrinking population doesn't necessarily have to be a catastrophe. It directly challenges those alarmist warnings you hear, like Elon Musk talking about population collapse.
Right. The argument here is that shrinkage isn't a calamity on normal timescales. Many of the common worries are actually kind of overblown.
Okay, so let's break those down. What are the main worries the article debunks?
Okay, three main ones. First, government debt. The worry is fewer people means less growth, making debt harder to sustain. But the article points out that declining interest rates because older populations save more and there are fewer investment opportunities in a shrinking economy could actually make debt more manageable. The IMF seems to agree, suggesting older societies will keep saving for later life.
That's a fascinating counterpoint. Okay, what about the burden of an aging population? That seems like a real concern.
It is a concern. The working age population shrinks, more elderly need care. But the crucial factor isn't just the size of the working age group, it's how many are actually in work.
Participation rates.
Exactly. Increasing participation rates, because many working age adults aren't currently employed, and rising retirement ages can significantly mitigate this. The typical worker in a rich country now works 4 years longer than in 2000.
4 years longer.
Yeah. And remarkably, the average 70-year-old in 2022 had similar cognitive abilities to a 53-year-old back in 2000. Plus, let's not forget, young people also cost a lot. Education, healthcare.
Good point. Okay, third worry. Innovation decline. Fewer people, fewer ideas.
That's the fear. But the article argues the world is far from exhausting its capacity for innovation. Even with fewer people, a good chunk could still focus on research. Like Israel, which has the highest share of workers in R&D, still only devotes about 1% of its workforce to it.
Yeah.
Huge potential elsewhere.
And AI plays a role here too.
Definitely. The article suggests AI could significantly boost productivity and offset a shrinking labor pool. So it's a powerful counter to the idea of running out of new ideas.
So the overall conclusion is?
Governments should focus on preparing for older societies rather than trying these futile attempts to boost birth rates. Policies like Hungary spending a massive 6% of GDP on pronatal policies have largely failed to increase total births anyway. It's about accepting this new demographic reality strategically.
Okay, transitioning from population shifts to technological ones.
Mm.
The AI revolution is undoubtedly one of the grandest narratives right now.
Yeah.
Marked by boom, bust, and just a rapidly evolving landscape. Let's start with that AI stock market boom.
Yeah, it's been incredible. Since ChatGPT launched in 2022, the U.S. stock market's jumped by, what, $21
trillion? $21 trillion.
And an astonishing 55% of that increase comes from just 10 firms. You know, Amazon, Broadcom, Nvidia, Oracle, all riding that AI wave. This year alone, $400 billion spent on AI infrastructure, projected to hit $3 trillion by 2028.
That scale is just immense. But it also brings concerns, right? Like bubble territory.
Big concerns. Many analysts are warning about irrationally exuberant valuations. They're drawing parallels to the dot-com bubble, mentioning companies like Global Crossing. Torsten Slok at Apollo says AI stocks are even more richly valued now than dot-com stocks were in 99.
Wow.
Even OpenAI's Sam Altman admits investors are overexcited. But, you know, history lessons from past tech bubbles, railways, electric light, show that while booms didn't stop the tech, they often led to shifts in who the leading firms were.
So a crash wouldn't kill AI, but maybe shuffle the deck.
Exactly. A crash would likely see upstarts replacing current leaders rather than stopping AI itself.
Now here's a crucial twist. Despite all the hype, there seems to be this waning faith in godlike large language models, the LLMs.
Yeah, progress at the absolute frontier of generative AI seems to be slowing down compared to those initial breakthroughs. The article likens it to ho-hum phone upgrades.
Like the new iPhone reveal.
Pretty much. It says GPT-5's reception was kind of a collective shrug, similar to how people react now to the annual iPhone update.
So if the giant models are slowing, what's rising?
This is giving rise to small language models, or SLMs. Firms are increasingly opting for cheaper, nimbler, bespoke SLMs. They can be tailored for specific needs.
Because your HR chatbot doesn't need to know quantum physics.
Exactly. As IBM's David Cox put it, these SLMs are easier to run in-house, great for AI agents, smartphones, self-driving cars, anywhere. Energy efficiency and speed matter. It might even validate companies like Apple, who were maybe slower on the big cloud LLMs.
Okay, but all these AI agents getting built into our phones or computers,
Yeah.
that raises huge privacy and security flags, doesn't it? How serious are those concerns?
Oh, they're substantial. Meredith Whitaker from the Signal Foundation warns this push threatens privacy, security, and competition.
How so?
Well, a stark example cited is Siri transmitting WhatsApp message transcripts to Apple servers for Apple Intelligence. That effectively undermines WhatsApp's end-to-end encryption because now Apple is an end in your supposedly private chat.
Yikes, that's not good.
Not good at all. It breaches privacy, but also threatens competition. These new AI agents are bypassing APIs the usual way apps talk to each other, potentially scraping competitors' data and generating market insights for the big AI giants.
So what's the solution?
Whitaker argues for privacy by default developers marking sensitive apps off limits, radical transparency from the OS vendors, and serious investment in security research to protect private communication and keep competition healthy. It really makes you ask, what are the true costs of convenience when our most sensitive data is involved?
Definitely something to think about. Okay, from the current tech boom, let's pivot to something that sounds like pure sci-fi but is surprisingly real. Tabletop fusion reactors.
Yeah, this is cool. The article discusses the Farnsworth fuser, which is actually a 60-year-old idea for benchtop fusion reactors. Simple enough for hobbyists to build, but they don't actually generate power.
Until now, maybe.
Well, that's the exciting part. There's this startup, Avalanche Energy, founded by Brian Riordan and Robin Langtry. They used to work at Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin. They're aiming for a barrel-sized 15-kilowatt power-generating reactor by 2029. That would be monumental if they pull it off.
How does it work? What's different?
Their device, the Orbitron, modifies Farnsworth's design. It uses a cylindrical geometry as magnetic fields. Basically, it increases the plasma density significantly and sustains fusion longer, making sure the nuclei rarely hit the cathode. It's some clever engineering.
And the potential applications for miniature fusion power. That sounds game-changing.
Oh, the potential is vast. Imagine powering robot ships, submarines, remote Arctic bases without needing traditional fuel. Huge military applications, too. And it could revolutionize spacecraft much more power than current nuclear batteries.
The article even quips it could be just the thing on Mars.
Exactly. Highlights the potential for deep space exploration, maybe even future colonies. It's a powerful reminder that even as some AI hype cools, other areas of science are still pushing boundaries, promising truly world-changing tech.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the American crossroads. A nation really grappling with fractured politics and deepening social divides. A really stark example of this is the tragic murder of Charlie Kirk, the 31-year-old founder of Turning Point USA, TP USA.
Yeah, a shocking event. Former President Trump called him legendary. And it follows what the article calls a spate of politically motivated attacks in recent years, including those two attempts on Trump's own life. It's a chilling sign of the escalating political temperature.
Kirk's impact was undeniable, wasn't it? A formidable organizer.
Absolutely. TPUSA became this juggernaut, tens of millions in revenue by 2023. He energized young voters for Trump, shaped the Republican Party significantly. Surprisingly, he was the most trusted individual under 30 on TikTok for Trump voters in 2024.
Wow. And his ideology.
He believed wokeism threatened the country, wanted to reclaim America for Jesus Christ. His murder, in the context of other attacks on Democratic governors, Supreme Court justices, Pelosi home, it just underscores the severe partisan rancor gripping the U.S.
Experts link this rising violence not just to elites condemning it, but also these exaggerated perceptions of what rivals will tolerate.
Right. And Kirk himself once said, when people stop talking, that's when you get violence. A very sobering thought, given what happened to him.
This brings us to another powerful figure, Donald Trump, and what the article describes is his sinister brilliance in security theater.
Yeah, he's a master of it. Constantly exaggerating dangers, migrants are the worst of the worst, cities are hellholes, and then ordering these highly camera-friendly actions.
Like the alligator Alcatraz migrant cage.
That, icy trucks with his name on them, even ordering missiles to destroy alleged Venezuelan drug gangsters. It's a performance designed to captivate and maybe provoke his base.
So what are the aims of this theater?
Several key aims, really. First, reassure supporters he's the unflinching protector. Second, deter wrongdoers by signaling maximum lethality, not tepid legality, as his Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, put it. Third, it's a strategic move in his battle with the courts over presidential power limits. Claiming authority to execute alleged smugglers without trial, detain people under the Alien Enemies Act, even though courts call these arguments far-fetched.
But this theater involves a lot of deception.
Right? Oh, definitely. Statistics show most IC arrestees aren't dangerous criminals. Enforcement varies by state. Often more public arrests happen in Democratic areas. It really raises that crucial question. How much does performance overshadow reality? And what happens to Democratic institutions when a president uses power like this as a political weapon?
Okay, shifting to a completely different corner of the American political map.
Yeah.
The Democratic Socialists. The article asks, who's afraid of the Democratic Socialists?
Yeah. Zoran Mamdani, the Democratic nominee for NYC mayor, is also a Democratic Socialist. It highlights their rising influence. Still a small party membership-wise, but their addressable audience is huge.
Oh, huge.
Two-thirds of Democrats have a positive view of socialism, and many view their own party negatively.
That's a significant ideological shift. What does socialism mean in this context? It seems varied.
It is varied. For figures like Sanders or AOC, it's often closer to European social democracy. For Mamdani, it stems more from Palestinian rights issues. The term itself has this subversive appeal, right? A way to show you're an outsider challenging elites.
And the article suggests it's emerging as the left's populist alternative to Trumpism.
That's the idea. Which is kind of ironic because Trumpism itself has led to this new form of American state capitalism, government interventions with U.S. steel, Intel, those tariffs.
Right.
Mamdani, though, drawing inspiration from past sewer socialists, pledges to deliver excellence in public services. It shows a pragmatic side, focused on tangible results for people. Hashtag #B, economic policy and social safety nets.
Okay, turning to economic policy and social safety nets now. We see some critical challenges facing institutions like Planned Parenthood. It plays such a crucial role in U.S. healthcare.
Absolutely. Over 9 million services in 2024, 5 million STI tests alone, serves 1 in 3 women, 1 in 10 men. And its biggest financier for non-abortion care is Medicaid.
Which makes it particularly vulnerable to funding challenges. What are the main threats?
Two major fronts. First, that One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It proposes a one-year ban on federal Medicaid payments to abortion providers who got over $800,000 in 2023.
Which could be devastating, right? Mm-hmm. Even for clinics mostly doing non-abortion care.
Potentially blocking entire networks, yeah. Second, a Supreme Court ruling, Medina v. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, allows states to block providers from Medicaid. That'll hit states already hostile to abortion access hard.
And the consequences are pretty stark.
They are. When Texas blocked Planned Parenthood back in 2013, contraception use fell, Medicaid-covered births went up, public hospitals would struggle to meet the demand, people would fall through cracks. The CBO even projects it would cost the federal government tens of millions due to more births.
This fight over healthcare funding leads right into a broader budget battle, which the article says offers Democrats a chance to show some backbone.
Right, because Trump's one big beautiful bill includes deep health care cuts. The CBO estimates they could cause nearly 11 million people to lose health insurance.
11 million. Wow.
So this presents a crucial strategic moment for the Democrats. They see a clear chance to oppose these cuts, use the funding deadline to push for reversals, maybe agree to extend ACA subsidies past the 2026 midterms as a smaller compromise.
The big test of their resolve, then. A moment to show commitment to protecting those safety nets.
Definitely. It really underscores how deeply healthcare policy is tangled up with federal budgets and all that political maneuvering. Hashtag tax Shay local governance and direct democracy.
Moving down to the local level, San Francisco is experiencing what the article colorfully calls recall fever.
Huh. Recall fever.
Residents in the Sunset District are rallying to recall their county supervisor, Joel Engardio. Why? For supporting turning a coastal highway into a park. Apparently, even pets are protesting.
Pets protesting. That's dedication. It's a fascinating case study in direct democracy, though. Historically, these tools, initiatives, referendums, recalls were championed by progressive reformers to check power, like railroad monopolies.
But now they're used differently.
Often, yeah. Politicians use them to deflect blame or weaken opponents. Recalls have become normal politics since Gray Davis was ousted in 2003. It's like a behavioral contagion across California. San Franciscans fired school board members, their DA, just in 2022.
And the irony for Engardio.
He actually supported those 2022 recalls, and he put the highway question on the ballot himself. But then his own district overwhelmingly opposed it, and now he might get recalled over it.
Wow. Shows how much democracy is too much, maybe.
Perhaps. And the local opposition to change not just the park, but housing density, too, it underscores this desire residents have for more participatory democracy, more meetings, more veto points, even if it leads to political instability.
Right, let's venture now into the Americas and the Pacific. Shifting alliances, power plays,
yeah,
really reshaping the geopolitical map. Starting with Latin America, the article describes Trump's aggressive stance as well, making the Americas great again.
Yeah, quite the headline. The U.S. is acting with unprecedented aggression. Armed forces destroying a speedboat from Venezuela, suspected of drugs, killing 11 people. Secretary of State Marco Rubio vowing to eradicate drug cartels. The Secretary of War Pete Hegseth calling Marines the front lines of counter-narcotics.
It's not just strong words, though. There are significant pressure tactics, too.
Oh, yeah. Trump's bullying countries on immigration, drugs, imposing tariffs on Mexico, threatening Colombia with sanctions for having failed demonstrably on drug trafficking. His administration pushes countries to shun Chinese projects, too.
But the insight here is that this aggressive nationalism could seriously backfire.
Profoundly backfire. Nearly all South American countries now trade more with China than the U.S. Brazil shrugged off tariffs. Chile is diversifying. Even Argentina's Trump-leaning President Milei renewed a credit line with China despite U.S. objections.
So the pressure isn't working.
Doesn't seem to be. Demand for drugs stays high. Trump's actions actually seem to strengthen figures like Lula in Brazil. And it makes American security promises look weak, pushing the region further away.
And beyond these broad policies, there's also specific support for authoritarian leaders.
Absolutely. Trump openly backs leaders like El Salvador's Nayib Bukele, who pleases Trump by jailing deportees from the U.S. Trump called Brazil's Bolsonaro trial a witch hunt, imposed tariffs on Brazil to try and influence its courts.
Which is a sharp contrast to traditional U.S. diplomacy.
Completely. And it further alienates countries, ultimately undermining long-term U.S. influence and soft power in the region.
Okay, hopping over to Argentina. President Javier Milei just suffered his first significant political defeat.
Right. His Libertarian Party was trounced in Buenos Aires province legislative elections. Lost by 13 points to the Peronist opposition, markets reacted immediately, stocks fell, the peso slumped 7%.
So what does this mean? Are investors getting nervous?
Definitely jittery. They fear voters are tiring of Milei's severe austerity measures. He's had amazing success, lowering inflation from 12% a month down to about 2%. But it's come at the cost of economic growth, which is really faltering.
So his core agenda, fiscal rectitude, is at risk.
That's the worry, yeah. It's central to investor faith in him. However, it's worth noting, provincial results aren't always great predictors for national elections. Milei's stronger nationally, turnout will likely be higher for the midterms.
So it's not necessarily the end of his reforms.
Not necessarily. He's vowed to accelerate them, might pivot to widen his coalition. It's definitely a wake-up call, though.
Meanwhile, in Brazil, we saw that epical conviction. Jair Bolsonaro sentenced to 27 years and 3 months for plotting a coup after the 2022 election.
A monumental moment, especially since Bolsonaro had famously said his campaign could only end in jail, death, or victory. Basically dismissing jail, he was wrong.
And this conviction, it offers a critical insight into the resilience of democratic institutions, doesn't it?
It really does. The coup plot was extensive associates planned to kill Lula, his VP, a Supreme Court judge. It failed mainly because the army wouldn't support it.
And the court stood firm.
Remarkably so. Brazil's Supreme Federal Court showed real judicial independence. They dismissed Bolsonaro's technical defense, emphasizing the severe threat to democracy. Justice Flavio Dino even mentioned Trump's futile attempt to disrupt Brazil's justice system with sanctions and travel bans on judges.
Underscoring the international aspect and the court's resilience.
Exactly. Bolsonaro can appeal because there was one dissenting vote, but a change in outcome seems unlikely given the severity of the charges and the weight of evidence.
Okay, moving across to the Pacific now. The article vividly describes a knife fight for influence between the U.S., Australia, and China among the island states.
Yeah, knife fight paints a picture. China's already the dominant economic partner for many of these small nations and is actively seeking military access to ports, airfields.
Which would significantly complicate U.S. and Australian war plans over Taiwan.
Exactly. And this struggle isn't just about obvious military bases. It's more subtle. China gaining access to commercial facilities like ports in the Solomon Islands right next to old WWII airstrips. That's a major concern.
Because they have the building blocks for military use.
As Mihai Sora from the Lowy Institute put it, yeah. Melanesian countries, especially the Solomons, seem most open to Chinese overtures because of their big man patronage politics. Australia's working hard to counter that influence.
And this is where the geopolitics really heat up. China tried to use its leverage over the Solomons to sow discord within the Pacific Islands Forum, the PIF.
Right. Tried to get Taiwan recognizing countries excluded, maybe even set up a rival diplomatic group.
How did that play out?
A compromise was reached, temporarily averting a major split. They banned all non-member observers, China, America, the EU, from a key meeting, made many unhappy, but avoided a total rupture.
So it's an ongoing contest.
A permanent contest, as Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong describes it. China's constantly pushing their luck at airfields, ports, police academies across the region. It's a deep, ongoing struggle for strategic advantage in a vital part of the world. Hashtag tag V, China's shifting economic landscape and soft power.
Let's turn our focus now fully to China, a nation going through profound shifts in its economy and really leveraging its growing soft power. One huge development is China's concerted effort to ditch the dollar fast. From greenback to redback, the article calls it.
Yeah, and Trump's erratic trade policy, those big fiscal deficits, threats to the Fed's independence, they're clearly hurting the dollar. It's down 7% since January.
Which creates an epic opportunity for China.
That's the argument. The yuan, by contrast, hit its highest level since Trump's re-election. It's attracting foreign investors, governments looking for dollar alternatives.
This is their second big push to internationalize the yuan, right? The first one didn't go so well.
No, that ended painfully in 2015 after a stock market crash and currency devaluation. This time, officials seem eager for lasting progress, but they still want to keep a tight grip on capital flows.
So the goal is clear. Insulate exporters, blunt the threat of U.S. financial sanctions.
Exactly. But despite China being nearly a fifth of global GDP, the yuan's share in international payments is still only 4%. In central bank reserves, just 2%, largely due to those capital controls.
Most economists think full internationalization needs more liberalization, but China's aiming for something else.
Yeah, they seem set on a multipolar system where yuan competes, but without fully giving up control.
And this is where their strategy gets really interesting. They've been building this shadow system of non-dollar infrastructure.
Diligently building it, extending 4.5 trillion yuan, about $630 billion in swap lines to 32 central banks. That's a global safety net, arguably rivaling the IMF's. They've also got their own interbank messaging system, CIPS. Over 1,700 banks now, $24 trillion in transactions in 2024. And then there's the digital currency network, Enbridge.
Which already has geopolitical significance.
Yeah, it's being used by sanctioned entities like those in Xinjiang. This whole network is a strategic play to bypass the dollar system, mitigate sanctions, allows China to trade without touching dollars.
So the long-term view is this multipolar financial system where the yuan competes.
That's the vision from China's central bank governor, resisting full liberalization, creating a sort of global currency with Chinese characteristics. It's a quiet but powerful challenge to the dollar's long-standing dominance.
Okay, moving from high finance to consumer culture, there's this intriguing phenomenon gripping China, dubbed Dalafornication.
Dalafornication, I like it. It describes this new tourism trend, especially in places like Dali, that laid-back backpacker city.
Right. While wealthy city dwellers are being cautious with spending because of the property crisis, Dali's streets and cafes are apparently bustling. Suggests a different consumer story.
And the core insight is, it's not about high-income spending. Domestic trips were up 20% in the first half of 2025, total spending up 15%. But crucially, spending per trip was down over 4% from a year ago, only slightly higher than 2019.
Suggesting a boom in lower-income travelers.
Strongly suggests it. Consumer sentiment might be low in the flashy megacities, but it's brighter in poorer, smaller interior cities home to a billion Chinese. Retail spending growth is much higher there, like almost 8% in Henan versus decline in Beijing. Big regional difference.
So what are the implications of this growing low-income leisure class for China's economy?
It highlights a crucial challenge, how to unlock consumer demand. Catering to this low spenders group is now essential for boosting the whole economy. Local governments are already promoting cheap travel options, like that 10 yuan football league in Jiangsu that drew tourists.
So shop owners in Dali need to embrace the freeloaders, as the article puts it.
Pretty much. They need these low spenders to thrive in this new economic landscape. It's a fundamental shift in understanding who's driving consumer behavior in China, moving away from just focusing on the urban elite.
In a lighter but still insightful vein, Chinese comedy is having a moment. Director Fang is laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, Fang, 50 years old, from Linyi, became a stand-up star after being on a top comedy show. Her Beijing shows sell out in seconds.
What's her focus? What makes her popular?
What's noteworthy is her focus on women's issues, especially her experiences with a difficult marriage. She riffs on these topics, advises women to mock prejudice, and importantly, earn money while mocking it.
That's empowering.
Very. Her popularity, especially among women, comes from that. As one local woman said, if a 50-year-old can stand up, why can't we? It reflects this powerful cultural current women finding their voice, using humor as a sharp tool for empowerment, challenging norms. #, Chinese trade thriving, despite America's attacks.
Finally, on China, despite Trump's aggressive rhetoric and tariffs, Chinese trade isn't just surviving, it's thriving, proving remarkably resilient.
Yeah, Trump repeatedly called China the chief ripper offer, deepest, darkest China, imposed high tariffs.
But the core insight is,
while exports to America plunged by a quarter, the U.S. share dropped from 15% to 10%. China's total shipments actually rose 6% year on year.
How? Trade diversification.
Exactly. China strategically shifted focus. Exports to Africa surged by a third, to Asian countries up a fifth, to Europe up nearly a tenth. And the Belt and Road Initiative has significantly bolstered this. Record $120 billion in activity in the first half of 2025, fueling trade, especially in Africa with big construction contracts.
So China is essentially rerouting trade and strengthening its global supply chain position at the same time.
Precisely. Cementing its role by moving production to ASEAN countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, that satisfies rules of origin, minimizes transshipment, but critically, it fixes Chinese firms' central role in the trade network. It's a nuanced but highly effective strategy, showing China's ability to adapt and expand its economic influence despite direct U.S. opposition, leading to a much more multipolar global trade system, #Z, European economic recovery and political undercurrents, #ZA, Europe's economy at last shows signs of a recovery.
Okay, let's turn back to Europe now. Despite all those deep-seated challenges we talked about, the economy is finally showing some clear signs of recovery.
Yeah, which is kind of surprising, isn't it? On the surface, things looked pretty grim. The IMF projecting only tiny growth for the big economies, France's government collapsing, Trump's tariffs, the Ukraine war.
Right. Long shadows. But there's resilience.
Quite striking resilience, revealed by some surprising indicators.
Yeah.
The Purchasing Managers Index for European manufacturing hit a multi-year high in August. German business expectations are the highest since the Ukraine war started.
And Spain's economy is doing particularly well.
Really strong. Robust growth in manufacturing and services, significantly boosted by immigration from Latin America. These are genuinely positive signs against that backdrop of pessimism.
So what's driving this unexpected turnaround? What are the factors?
Several things seem to be at play. Inflation is almost beaten just over 2% in August. Interest rates are starting to come down.
Okay.
That's improving construction, setting the stage for more consumer spending. Consumers have recently won higher real wages and still have an elevated savings rate.
Government spending helps too.
Yeah, EU members are investing in their armed forces. Italy and Spain have substantial unspent EU recovery money that'll soon flow into the economy. Plus, European firms are actively diversifying trade beyond the US and China, looking at Mercosur, the Middle East.
And investment in tech.
Right. The European Investment Bank's investing 70 billion euros in tech-focused enterprises by 2027.
Right.
Venture capital sentiment seems solid.
But there are still risks that could derail this recovery. The article mentions headwinds.
Absolutely. The risks are still significant. Harsher Trump tariffs, a worsening French political crisis, stalling structural reforms. They're all still there. However, the overall feeling seems to be that markets and firms are adjusting to a difficult new era.
So adaptation is key.
That adaptation, plus the positive drivers, offers some cautious optimism for continued recovery, despite those headwinds. It's kind of a testament to Europe's underlying strength and ability to adjust.
But despite those glimmers of recovery, Europe seems to face this critical urgency deficit, especially when it comes to implementing bold, necessary reforms.
Yeah, that's the flip side. A year ago, Mario Draghi's report on European competitiveness warned of a slow agony without those reforms. Yet, a year on, very little of his big recommendations, like a bonfire of red tape, expanding the single market, have actually happened.
What's the persistent issue holding things back?
Fiscal fragmentation seems to be a big part of it. Germany quickly shot down a proposal for even a moderately bigger EU budget funded by joint debt. It highlights that grating sense of deja vu about structural issues that just keep plaguing the continent.
Kyriakos Pyrakakis, Greece's finance minister, had some strong words on this.
He did. He emphasized that completing the single market is crucial, but it's not enough. He pointed out that intra-EU barriers act as a de facto tariff of 44% on goods and a massive 110% in services.
Wow, that high. Much higher than barriers between U.S. states.
Far higher. It really makes you ask, how can Europe truly compete if it stays so internally fragmented?
He also stressed the need for more strategic resource pooling, right? How does that connect?
Yeah, he argues Europe needs to be more strategic about where resources are pooled, sector by sector. He highlights telecommunications, 27 different regulatory regimes, separate 5G spectrum options.
Compared to unified approaches in the U.S. and China.
Exactly. He cites Greece's national-level innovation using some of its 5G option money to fund companies building 5G applications as an example of what coordinated European action could achieve.
And regulation needs to align with future growth.
That's his other key point. Regulation, like the Public Procurement Directive, needs to support future priorities. AI, cybersecurity, energy transition not be stuck in the past. The goal, he says, is an economy that innovates, competes, grows with institutions that catalyze potential, not just manage risk. #TechHexy. A crisis in long-term care of Europe's elderly.
Now, a quieter but equally pressing crisis unfolding across Europe. The long-term care of its elderly. Europe's population is aging fast. Median age 43, global median 31.
Yeah, and by 2050, 6% of EU citizens will be over 85, more than double the current share. Southern and Eastern Europe are hit hardest, oldest, losing young people fastest. Italy's median age is 49. Greece, Lithuania, Latvia expect their working age population to drop by a fifth by 2050.
This demographic shift means the need for long-term care, LTC, is just going to balloon.
Huge increase. From nearly 20 million people over 50 needing care in 2020 to over 27 million by 2050. And a key insight here is the stark difference in public spending on LTC across Europe.
How stark?
Sweden spends over 25% of its health budget on LTC, Southern and Eastern Europe, less than 10%. And the labor supply for LTC is dwindling too. LTC workers are 7% of the workforce in Sweden, but less than 1% in Romania, Cyprus, Greece.
And in some places, it's almost non-existent.
Like Bulgaria. Services barely exist. No official dementia stats for a decade. No gerontology specializations and medical degrees. It's creating a looming humanitarian crisis.
So neglecting this now just creates bigger problems later, essentially penalizing future generations.
Precisely. As one researcher put it, insufficient investment now will penalize another generation. Informal carers, often family, bear the brunt. They reduce work hours, quit jobs, don't contribute to pensions or savings.
It makes you wonder about the true long-term economic and social cause of not investing.
Exactly. And Europe is an early warning sign for regions like Latin America and Africa, where older populations will double or treble in 3 decades, and public healthcare spending is already low. Investing early in LTC is crucial to blunt that future fiscal strain and avoid a generational crisis that'll be way more costly later. #D, Italy's coalition sends mixed messages on Ukraine and Russia.
Okay, shifting quickly to Italy. Its coalition government seems to be sending mixed messages on Ukraine and Russia, reflecting maybe the ambivalent views of Italian voters.
Yeah, populist deputy PM Matteo Salvini, leader of the League Party, he's again advocating for Russia. He's expressed admiration for Putin before, famously wore that t-shirt with Putin's face in the European Parliament.
So how does that play out in the coalition? It's a study in politics, right?
Definitely. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, who is strongly pro-Ukraine, has had to make concessions to keep the coalition together. She nominated Salvini's former diplomatic advisor as ambassador to Moscow, a clear nod to his party.
But the League denies it's a real shift towards Moscow.
Right. They frame it as just appreciating Trump's efforts for a peace deal. It suggests Salvini will probably stick to provocative yet symbolic statements against military engagement rather than actually threatening coalition stability. It's a delicate balancing act, showing how internal politics can really shape foreign policy on critical issues. #E, meet the leader of Europe's anti-Trump resistance.
Finally, within Europe, the article identifies Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez as the leader of Europe's anti-Trump resistance.
Yeah, he's taken a remarkably firm stance, confronting Trump's trade tariffs, raising concerns about U.S. social media platforms harming democracy.
His opposition has been quite proactive.
Truly noteworthy. He urged the EU to fight Trump's unjustified and unfair tariffs, suggested channeling retaliatory tariffs to affected European businesses. At Davos, he criticized powerful U.S. social media firms and tech billionaires, urged the EU to enforce its own laws against hate speech and disinformation referencing the Digital Services Act, which Trump hates.
And at NATO.
Spain was alone in rejecting Trump's demand for 5% GDP defense spending, called it incompatible with our worldview, promised 2.1% instead. He also toured Latin America, spoke alongside Trump skeptics like Lula, vowed to fight an alliance of oligarchs on the far right.
But this confrontational stance isn't without criticism, is it? Risks alienating a powerful ally.
Indeed. Allies, even friendly Spanish news outlets, worry Spain's losing clout. That antagonizing Trump outweighs benefits. Latin American governments are also wary of provoking U.S. wrath, despite their own issues with Trump.
So it raises that question, how effective is unilateral resistance?
Right. To defend liberal values, the article suggests Europe needs to be stronger, implying more defense spending, and build broader coalitions, even across party lines. The concluding thought is pretty stark. Alone, resistance is sadly futile, emphasizes the urgent need for unity. #7, science, health, and society's edges.
Okay, let's shift now to science, health, and some of society's, well, more challenging edges. The opioid crisis, that persistent global problem, is sadly evolving. There's the emergence of nitazenes, a new and extremely dangerous class of synthetic opioids.
Yeah, these are drugs developed back in the 50s, but never medically approved. Now they're spreading globally, Ireland, Sierra Leone, Australia.
And the main danger is their potency.
Extreme potency. Hundreds of times stronger than heroin. Some varieties are dozens of times stronger than fentanyl, which already causes tens of thousands of deaths in America yearly.
Yeah.
They have an extremely narrow therapeutic window, meaning the difference between an effective dose and a lethal one is tiny, hugely increases overdose risk, and crucially, because they were never approved, there's very little research on them. Makes it incredibly hard for doctors to understand and treat their effects.
And this surge in nitazenes, it's largely a supply-side reaction, a consequence of other drug restrictions.
Exactly. China banned fentanyl analogs in 2019. Domestic production plummeted. The Taliban outlawed opium production in Afghanistan in 2021. These efforts pushed illicit producers towards alternatives, leading to this rapid spread of nitazenes.
It illustrates that fundamental challenge in drug prohibition, doesn't it? Crack down on one drug, producers innovate with something even more dangerous.
Precisely. And the tragic consequence is accidental overdoses. Especially among young recreational users. They might consume tiny lethal amounts mixed into other drugs like cocaine or ecstasy, often with no opioid tolerance, leading to deaths of people who never even intended to take an opioid.
And the regulatory challenge is immense.
Huge. Authorities ban individual nitazenes, but producers just easily tweak the chemical structure. So now governments, like the UK and China, are using generic definitions to try and ban all derivatives of a core chemical structure, attempting to stay ahead in this grim chemical arms race. #tag#B, life on Mars. NASA finds potential biosignature.
In a completely different scientific realm, NASA's made an incredible discovery that could point to life on Mars.
Yeah, the Perseverance rover found a potential biosignature in a Martian rock sample from Sapphire Canyon in the Jezero Crater Valley. Could be the clearest sign of life that we've ever found on Mars, according to NASA's acting administrator.
So what's the evidence? What did they find?
It's compelling. The mudstone had organic molecules, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, essential building blocks for life, though not exclusively from life. But more compellingly, the rock had these leopard spots with reduced minerals. That's an effect bacteria commonly produce on Earth.
That's specific chemistry.
This peculiar sort of chemistry, yeah. If seen in Earth sediments with organic matter, it would strongly suggest a biological origin, making it excitingly suggestive for Mars.
That's astonishing. A kind of discovery that changes everything. But there's a big problem, isn't there? The sample is still on Mars.
Indeed. Sealed in a titanium canister on Mars. But NASA canceled the missions needed to bring it back for study, citing an $11 billion price tag.
$11 billion. So the U.S. has no way to retrieve its own potentially groundbreaking discovery.
Seems that way. It really raises questions about priorities in space exploration, especially since the Chinese Space Agency, CNSA, has its own Mars sample return mission planned.
So China might get there first.
The article notes the implausibly idealistic idea of cooperation in this new space race, suggests the U.S.'s main competitor is unlikely to help and might just run on past with their own discoveries.
Okay, let's move from the red planet to naval warfare, where the future of conflict is being reshaped by tech. The article explores Top Gun without Maverick, looking at the increasing inevitable role of drones.
Yeah, some predict aircraft carriers are dead in the water in 20 years, but navies are actually investing in new ones. They're just fundamentally reinventing their air wings with drones.
And this is a global trend.
Absolutely. U.S., Turkey, South Korea, France, China, all integrating large combat drones, loyal wingmen, or armed drones onto carriers, amphibious assault ships. China showed off some launched from its assault ships at a parade.
So why the big shift to drones? What are the reasons?
Three main reasons, really. First, drones handle the grunt work. Frees up crewed aircraft for complex tasks, like a quadcopter delivering spare parts instead of tying up a crewed helicopter for hours. Optimizes resources.
Makes sense. And the risks and costs, I assume drones offer big advantages there.
Exactly. Second, big risk and cost reduction. Drones are less costly to lose, easier to replace, and easier to sustain. Lets navies use them in larger numbers without the same financial or, crucially, human life consequences.
And third,
greater design flexibility. No pilot means less health and safety scrutiny, easier upgrades. The space for a pilot and life support can be filled with more fuel, extending range. This is driving fundamental changes in naval tactics, maybe dispersing forces more widely. Look at Ukraine's use of those Magura speedboats armed with missiles to take down Russian jets.
But this evolution isn't without challenges. Cultural rigidity, ethical concerns about autonomy.
Not at all. There's cultural rigidity. Fighter pilots often run decision-making, resistance to drones. Autonomy concerns are huge. What if jamming cuts a pilot off from a drone, especially one carrying weapons?
Right.
And advanced reusable drones with onboard processing and sensors are getting bigger and pricier, offsetting some savings. This leads to that profound question. How much autonomy do you give drones for lethal force? Algorithms could maybe replicate human targeting criteria, but the article notes, we are in the foothills of full autonomy. These are complex decisions navies are just starting to grapple with. Massive ethical and operational implications. ##TAG8, global business, sports, and cultural currents. ##TAG any of dynasties and corporate culture.
Okay, let's explore global business, sports, and cultural currents now. Starting with the fascinating world of media dynasties, that decades-long succession battle at Rupert Murdoch's empire, it's finally over. Lachlan Murdoch, 54, is the new mogul.
Yeah, inheriting controlling stake in Fox and News Corp. Combined value, $42 billion. Immense influence, Fox News, Wall Street Journal. His siblings reportedly took $1 billion each to give up their votes, settling what was called a 30-year job interview.
And the key insight about Lachlan is his political flexibility, similar to his father.
Seems so. Rupert was pragmatic, shifted support between parties, initially hated Trump, then embraced him. Lachlan mirrors this, donates to a gay museum, but also sees Trump as good for business for appealing to middle America.
So the implication is the firms continue on their profitably conservative path.
Looks like it. Makes a breakup or spinning off assets less likely. Lachlan might even try to combine the two companies again. A new chapter for this huge media empire.
Okay, moving to something universally relatable in corporate culture. The annual performance review gets a humorous but critical look in the Bartleby column, nicknamed Anne.
Huh. Anne. A process disliked by many, but still everywhere in companies worldwide.
What's the enduring paradox here? Why does it persist despite the criticism?
Well, the criticisms are valid. Often ineffective, forgotten till crunch time, managers cut and paste remarks, feedback is too infrequent, yet it persists.
Why?
Because it ensures at least one formal chat between employee and manager, provides a forum for issues, feeds into pay promotion decisions, reminds managers their employees exist, allows employees to document performance, ambitions. Ultimately, people want formality in key decisions, and managers find it useful for goal setting, managing underperformers. Makes you wonder about the future of formal feedback in today's work environment.
Definitely. Now, in global brands, Nestle, usually a steady growth engine, is in what the article calls madhouse mode. Third boss in just over a year.
Yeah, two previous CEOs ousted, falling share price down almost a third since Feb 2022. One case involved not disclosing a relationship with a subordinate.
So what caused this turbulence? Just leadership changes?
A perfect storm, really. Rising raw material costs, supply chain disruption, interest rates, flagging consumer sentiment, all hit sales. Plus, a string of scandals. Buitoni E. coli, sugar pack baby food in poor countries, trading in Russia, banned Perrier purification methods.
Oof. So who's taking over now?
Philippe Nevertil, the Nespresso boss, is the new CEO. Pablo Ayllo, former Inditex boss, is the new chairman. They're expected to streamline the portfolio, maybe sell off water businesses, vitamin brands, restore sales, and crucially, boost innovation and morale among dejected staff and investors. Huge undertaking.
Shifting to French business now, the article makes a surprising claim. In French business, boring beats sexy.
Yeah, despite France's haute couture image, the luxury firms LVMH, Hermès are suffering. Shed hundreds of billions in value, Trump's trade war, Chinese consumer gloom. The CAC 40 index is dead last among rich world indices.
So where is the solace found, if not in the glamorous sectors?
In the unsexy exceptions, as the article puts it, includes perennial disappointments like Danone, Orange, Societe Generale. They've had a surprising turnaround, now top performers. Also, smaller French firms, less vulnerable to global disruption. An MSCI index of French minnows climbed 15%.
And the least chic winners.
Utilities and builders. Engie, Veolia, Saint-Gobain, Vinci, Schneider Electric, Legrand. Doubled operating profits, higher returns since 2019. It highlights this resilient, less glamorous sector providing real stability amidst France's broader turmoil.
And as Chinese companies race to go global, branding is a huge challenge. How do you pronounce BMOFDLKKK?
Exactly. Many struggle with names that work internationally. A prime example is Mixu, the cold drinks chain. Chinese name means honey snow, sounds nice, but they used a hard-to-pronounce phonetic version overseas, limited their growth.
So the lesson is?
Names must be easy to say for word of mouth to work. Simple but critical for global expansion. Shows even successful brands can stumble on basic cultural linguistic stuff.
Finally, in Southeast Asia, CLTD, Singapore's e-commerce king, is gearing up to battle TikTok.
Right. CLTD Shopee e-commerce, Garena Gaming, Money Fintech vying to be SE Asia's most valuable listed firm. Market value over $100 billion.
Shopee's been successful due to logistics.
Yeah. Investments in logistics like SPX Express enabled cheaper, faster delivery. They retained half the SE Asia e-commerce market. But the big threat now is social commerce.
Dominated by TikTok Shop.
which makes up a fifth of online shopping there. TikTok Shop's sales in the five biggest SE Asian economies doubled in the first half of 2025. Makes you wonder, can Shopee's own social offerings like Shopee Live compete against such a spry competitor that lives and breathes social media? The battle for online spending in that region is really heating up. Hashtag tag 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 B niche sports, pop culture, and intellectual pursuits.
Okay, let's shift now to the vibrant world of niche sports, pop culture, and intellectual pursuits. It seems investors are really piling into niche sports, everything from volleyball to tag.
Yeah, this boom seems fueled by a few things. The pandemic got lockdown audiences watching whatever sports were left. Post-COVID, there's huge demand for live entertainment. That volleyball match in Nebraska drew 92,000 fans, record for women's sport.
Wow. And streaming helps too. Unlimited schedules.
Exactly. Creates crucial space for smaller leagues. And the investment is significant. Private equity firms did almost half the sports industry deals in 2024. Deals nearly doubled. With top leagues hard to buy into, capital flows to smaller ones.
And these niche sports are often designed differently. For digital natives?
Often, yeah. Targeting short attention spans, like the TGL Golf League using simulators or Kings League Football with fan-voted role changes, creates a lively festival atmosphere. Monetization relies on media rights, sponsors, tickets. Social media is absolutely crucial for engagement, jersey sales.
But there are risks in this gold rush, yeah. Right? Not every niche sport makes it.
Absolutely. Only a few will likely grab sustained attention. The rush of capital can breed chaos. Remember pickleball, briefly having three official circuits. Dilutes everything. Some upstarts are already struggling with prize money. Makes you wonder how many will last and what this fragmentation means for sports entertainment overall.
Okay, shifting to pop music, an interesting trend. Why female pop stars are lambasting mediocre men.
No. Yeah, artists like Sabrina Carpenter, Manchild, Chaperone, Perry, Dua Lipa, combining catchy tunes with lyrics complaining about subpar men, you know, stupid, useless, don't dance, bad grammar.
It's quite pointed. What does this reflect?
The article suggests it reflects an evolution in songwriting. Since the late 60s, Joni Mitchell, later Beyoncé, Taylor Swift songwriting moved from universal themes towards more confessional storytelling, more personal, direct.
And this specific trend reflects a growing gulf between young men and women.
That's the cultural context suggested. These frustrations finding a creative outlet. Interestingly, some male artists are pushing back musically, like Morgan Wallen's I'm the Problem, indicates a broader cultural conversation playing out in the charts.
Shifting to art and design, the ironic ubiquity of William Morris's prints.
Right. A new exhibition, Morris Mania, celebrates his enduring appeal. Morris & Co. revenues hit 18 million pounds. His designs are just everywhere. Mugs, rugs, even nuclear submarine seats, countless period dramas.
Yeah, and the irony is...
The profound irony. William Morris himself was bitterly opposed to mass production, preferred handmade goods, natural dyes. Yet his designs are now widely imitated, even by AI, mass-produced for everything imaginable. Directly contradicts his socialist principles. He even wrote... How I Became a Socialist.
Even while his work adorned royal households.
Exactly. Queen Victoria, Tsar Nicholas II. It makes you ponder. How does an artist's vision reconcile with mass adoption, especially when it goes against their core beliefs?
Now, in athletics, a potential new megastar, Gout Gout, a 17-year-old sprinter from Australia.
Yeah, making his senior debut at the World Athletics Champs in Tokyo. Already drawing comparisons to Usain Bolt.
Seriously, what makes him so special?
His talent is striking. Fastest 16-year-old ever over 200 meters, 20.04 seconds. Faster than Bolt at the same age. His team thinks it's down to an unusually long and strong Achilles tendon. Gives him incredible elasticity, power.
So the potential is huge, but the pressure must be immense already.
Definitely. Main target is the 2028 LA Olympics, maybe 2032 Brisbane. His hometown, already signed by Adidas, draws huge crowds. His team's trying to temper expectations, but it highlights that challenge of managing such a prodigious young talent in the global spotlight.
Finally, for those who enjoy a bit of intellectual escapism, Dan Brown is back. The Secret of Secrets, offering another silly mashup of fact and fiction.
Ah, Dan Brown. His formula, facts which are just about right and prose which is just a bit wrong, has sold over 250 million copies. It works.
Despite the literary flaws critics point out, total bunkum mixed with facts.
Yeah, the appeal endures. The latest plot has Robert Langdon, the renowned symbologist, and his love interest, a noetic scientist, diving into a conspiracy about consciousness. The core idea is that the human mind in some way creates reality. links it to spiritual teachings, even business gurus.
So what's the appeal, despite the flaws?
It romps along, and its exposition explains complex topics, art, history, consciousness accessibly, makes it an exhilaratingly brainy thriller for many, even if it encourages that triangulation book in one hand, phone in the other, checking the facts, hashtag Houtro.
Well, that was quite the journey, wasn't it?
Yeah.
From those political tremors shaking Europe and the Americas to the really profound demographic shifts affecting our future and that intricate dance of AI and tech and markets.
Yeah, we covered a lot. We saw how local protests in Nepal can actually topple governments and how a single rock on Mars can spark this huge scientific mystery.
And what really stands out is just how interconnected everything is. Those shifting global power dynamics in trade, the subtle impacts of aging populations on economies, even that battle for privacy with AI agents. It all paints this complex dynamic picture of a world constantly in flux.
Absolutely. Whether it's the quiet tenacity of niche sports finding new audiences, or those loud debates around democratic socialism reshaping politics, every article in this week's Economist offers a crucial piece of the puzzle, reveals those deep currents.
This deep dive certainly brings home that idea. In this era of just rapid information flow, understanding the nuances, the implications, it's more crucial than ever.
It encourages you to look beyond the headlines, consider the deeper forces at work.
So for you, our discerning listener, here's a provocative thought to maybe mull over. If the world is constantly being reshaped by forces like demographic decline and the relentless rise of AI, and simultaneously by the volatile theater of global politics and shifting economic allegiances, what singular personal action do you believe would have the most profound positive impact on shaping your own future, and perhaps even contributing to the collective one?
Something to consider until our next deep dive.
Thank you so much for joining us for this in-depth look at The Economist. We'll be back soon with another stack of sources to unpack for you.